Hello there, and welcome back, everyone. This is Lachlan Peters, and you are listening to episode 12 of In the Shadows of Utopia podcast, and part 2 of Pol Pot in Paris. At the beginning and end of the last episode, I started outlining some of the broader context of this period in question, the backdrop in which a relatively unassuming student like Salot Sar would travel to Paris in 1949 and eventually come back to Cambodia about 3 years later as a committed communist and a revolutionary. Setting the backdrop to all of this is vital to a rounded explanation of the path toward the Khmer Rouge revolution, and involves developments in Cambodian politics, but also in Indochina, as well as the rest of the world. We spent a little bit more time on the Cambodian side of things in that episode, with Sihanouk presiding over the new relationship that France had struck up with its briefly independent colony, as political parties came onto the scene, but also anti-colonial movements like the Khmer Issarak. Meanwhile, in Vietnam, we explained how that process of the French returning was not quite as straightforward as it was in Cambodia. And soon after the end of the Second World War, the French Union would be struggling to defeat the new state that had been declared by Ho Chi Minh, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Before we return to Cambodian developments, or indeed to that burgeoning revolutionary career of Salot Sar, it's important that we discuss the conflict going on in Vietnam, as the evolution of that war from neo-colonial conquest to Cold War proxy, well, that's going to set in motion many gears that will turn the wheel of history toward the tragedies ahead. I may have mentioned this on the show before, but this is not a primarily military history-focused series. Now, naturally, we will deal with the fighting of wars. However, I am less interested in that fighting of them than I am with the effects on history and the people that fight them. So we will not be doing, you know, a deep dive tactical who shot who and when with what and what general said this and when. We're not going to make this all about Dien Bien Phu. The first French Indochina War is more than that, although we'll naturally talk about it. I want to frame our discussion of the First Indochina War by starting off with a tragic and little-known event that occurs roughly 1 year after the war had begun, after the French had taken Hanoi away from the DRV, forcing the Viet Minh and their embryonic state into the jungles, the villages, the hills and hinterlands of Vietnam, to wage an asymmetric war. What I'm going to share is a sad tale in and of itself, but one made all the more so due to its potential to be repeated. This tragedy will begin early in the morning of November 29th, 1947, in the village of Mai Trac, in central Vietnam, or from the French perspective, the territory they called Annam. I won't spend too much time building the scenery here. You might do well to conjure up any idealized pastoral scene of a mid-century Vietnamese village, set against the green grass, emerald mountains, and partitioned paddies of rice, too beautiful to be the stage of what would follow. The village itself is positioned quite close to a river and, militarily speaking, an area of some importance if you were either trying to maintain the territory from a French perspective, or, equally so, an area which easily lends itself to the guerrilla tactics of the Viet Minh. The village and area surrounding it had been a strong base for the Viet Minh since the war against Imperial Japan and the August Revolution in World War II, and despite many attempts, the French Union had not been able to claim it back, foiled by either the nationalistic fervour of the villagers, or indeed routinely because they were subject to attacks from concealed and untraceable Viet Minh guerrillas. As a result, a concerted effort to remove the threat from the village was undertaken by the French. A considerable force, perhaps more than 200 troops, backed up by artillery, was going to surround the village at different points and ambush them late at night. The idea being to capture any Viet Minh they could, as well as confiscate any means that they would be able to wage war with, effectively casting a blanket of control over this important area. From the various sources I have been able to find about the events that took place in my truck, they're not many, it seems that around 2 a.m., a large contingent of the French forces began entering the surrounding areas of the village, encircling it, ready to pounce and unleash their might on a usually hidden enemy, caught by surprise and now trapped. However, as was often the case, the plan had been leaked. The villagers had been made aware of the forthcoming assault, and those Viet Minh who might have been caught were able to vanish into the jungle, avoiding any large-scale fighting, where they would have been outgunned and outnumbered. So, as these French Union soldiers began aggressively entering my truck, they were met only with those villagers who were not active participants in the military resistance. The elderly, the children, the women. All of the reports that I have read relay the same aspects of what happened next. Infuriated that their enemy had eluded them once again, the French Union soldiers began assaulting those that did remain. Shootings began, as well as rapes. And amongst the cries and screams of those women and children, the smoke and flames from the houses set afire in anger, a kind of pandemonium took hold of this village. Pandemonium, a word that conveys wild noise and chaos, yes, but also has its roots in Latin as the place of all demons, of hell, the capital of hell. Hours went by before the situation developed further. One witness to these events said that a few hundred of these villagers were then tied up and led at gunpoint to the foot of a nearby bridge on the Kianjiang River. Still, they refused to reveal their sons or husbands or friends' whereabouts. And after these defenseless people had been exposed to more abuse by the French soldiers, a barrage of machine gun fire was unleashed into the crowd. The same witness that had watched these villagers being taken to the bridge claimed that the river soon ran red with blood, as perhaps 200 or more people were murdered. The village, in flames, was then looted. The bodies of young and old left scattered or floating down the river. A memorial stele was erected and remains a focal point of sorrow. Even today, every year, the residents of my truck still burn incense and commemorate the victims of the massacre nearby the bridge where the majority of the victims were slain. Now, this story is barely known in France and is a chilling foreshadowing of the events that will take place at the hands of US soldiers in My Lai in 1968. Now, the reason I wanted to frame this part of our discussion about the First Indochina War with that story is precisely because of the parallels that it presents with the horrifying massacre that occurs about 20 years later in the Second Indochina War, or the American War, as opposed to the French one. It is also a sad reminder that it was not the first nor last village to be wiped out in such a manner. And this will occur at the hands of multiple belligerents in conflicts that occur in Indochina over the next 40 or so years. Yes, our attention should rightfully remain on the actions of those powers which sought to intervene in Vietnam, and in doing so began slaughtering innocent civilians, or dispensing death from above in B-52s. But the Viet Minh, or what we would frame as the North Vietnamese later, or indeed the Khmer Rouge, or the Lon Nol government which the communists will overthrow, all of these actors will show their capability to murder those outside of the typical battlefield combatants. The civilians of Indochina will be the primary victims of the wars in Indochina. But if we are looking at the fighting of these Vietnam wars, well, the similarities are immediately apparent. The David versus Goliath kind of dynamic between the Democratic Republic of Vietnam against the French Union, or later the United States. And although the French Union will not muster quite the same levels of military might that the US will later bring to the fight, they will still be waging war with jeeps, tanks, paratroopers, bombs, machine guns, and mortars. And once the US does start seriously backing the French Union, even familiar horrors like napalm will be unleashed in this first of the Indochinese wars. As I said before, it's less the actual fighting of these militaries that I'm interested in, and more the effects on the history and people of the region involved in the fighting. So why don't we spend one more moment on that? How can we even imagine the kind of impact that murdering a few hundred women, children, and elderly people might have on those who either survived or even heard about the massacre at My Trac? I mean, what more motivation could you have to continue fighting against what was easily framed as a foreign invader that only wished to subjugate you and the people you love and the land you were born in? And then, when the United States enters this conflict, what is essentially the same war just 20 years later, do you not think that these old hatreds would still remain? This utter contempt for any kind of foreign force in your land? How could the French project of reclaiming Vietnam as its colony once again, how could this stand the test of time if the people it was seeking to control could draw from this deep well of hatred towards them? Never mind any notions of class warfare or communist rhetoric. This war, particularly before 1950, I think it screams out as one of national liberation. And whether the central purpose changes or not, the perception of the war will change. at least in the eyes of some outside powers. This is going to look like something different, something that fits into the Cold War view of the world, which is rapidly developing at this time. The evolution of the First Indochina War, from something along the lines of neo-colonial repression of an indigenous nationalist movement, into something more like the imperative to halt the spread of a red tide of communism in Asia. Well, this first must be set against the backdrop of a kind of stalemate in the war itself. But rather than the opposing sets of trenches dug into the fields of the Western Front, this stalemate was of a different character. Despite all the advantages in technology and firepower that the French possessed, they were spread too thinly to control all of Indochina all of the time. Even the complete decimation of a village like My Trac, that's not going to stop the Viet Minh's silent return at night to bury the dead. The remote hills of the north, vast stretches of central Vietnam, and the deep jungles around the Mekong in the south became safe havens for the Viet Minh, who had been ousted from any of the cities that they had controlled following the August Revolution. But their forces, although committed and gaining strength, were in no position to be able to, outright challenge the French for any of the territories which this European power had control over. Christopher Gosher explains how this dynamic would play out over the years of the war in his History of Vietnam. Quote, "As a result, neither the French and their allies, nor the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and theirs, ever possessed sufficient force or weapons to control all of Vietnam all the time. Instead, they all administered competing archipelago-like states whose sovereignties and control over people and territories could expand and shrink as armies moved in and out and the balance of power shifted accordingly. Borders amongst these competing states expanded and contracted like sponges being squeezed." End quote. Not only does this kind of conflict inevitably lead to the kinds of frustrated and violent measures of reprisal against civilian populations, even just suspected of harboring enemy combatants, but it also pit two embryonic states, as Gosher puts it, against each other, with both of them needing to create their new nations in whatever spaces they could. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam in the hills and forests and jungles and villages, while the French Union, well, they're going to attempt to do so in the areas they control, like cities and areas more akin to a traditional control of the colonial empire. Remember, this isn't France against Vietnam. There are relatively few French people in the region, but they are trying to develop their idea of what they want Vietnam, in quotation marks, to be. And so are the Viet Minh. This begs the question of what a state or nation can be, in the same way that comparing a house to a motorhome or an apartment building can illustrate pretty different means of having a roof over your head. We're going to return to this idea in a moment, particularly for how a French vision of a union of Indochinese states will also face a kind of mirrored image, a shadow version of these states, as the Indochinese Communist Party looks to develop its own set of incorporated nations in opposition to the French Union. But before we do that, we might spend a moment just seeing how this conflict is about to be internationalized and ramped up in pretty serious ways. Now, I think we could, broadly speaking, split the First Indochina War into two distinct phases. The initial phase is following the French conquest of Hanoi and the DRV's move to keep fighting from the jungles. And then into this second phase, from about 1950 onward, where, due to developments elsewhere, the war takes on a new meaning. This Cold War meaning. The difference between two kids having a fight in the playground, one-on-one, and then this devolving into a brawl involving their friends and their friends' friends. We talked about this briefly in the last episode, but following the end of the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union would emerge as the world's two dominant superpowers of international relations. A bipolar system of international relations, with all that entails, will not be without its tensions. And if we want to call the outcomes of these tensions the Cold War, well, they defy simplistic introduction. Well, let's give it a go, and lay down at least a few foundations on what we've already mentioned in the show so far. Now, the first is post-war recovery, and the position of the United States. And we could say that American policy in the aftermath of World War II followed a straightforward logic. Their major goals being to restore and strengthen capitalism, minimize left-wing influence, and prevent the Soviet Union from extending its influence beyond those areas that the Red Army controlled at the end of the Second World War. It depends which way you want to go here and which frame, I guess, you want to look at this through, whether you want to explain this as spreading the capitalist markets and entrenching Western Europe into an American-dominated international system, or whether you want to place US policy here as more defensive and reacting to some of the expansion of the USSR and the possibility that there was another dictator in Europe looking to take over the world. Let's presume some combination thereof as a starting point. Whether you want to think of these as concerns or motivations, well, it develops into the policy of containment, a word that will bounce around any discussion of the Cold War and one worth explaining. So on the 5th of March, 1946, not even a year after the Second World War had ended, Winston Churchill gave a fairly enthralling speech at a university in Missouri, of which I will play a smidgen for you now.
Gentlemen, this is no time for generality, and I will venture to be precise. A shadow has fallen upon the scenes so lately lighted by the Allied victory. Nobody knows what Soviet Russia and its communist international organization intends to do in the immediate future. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. I do not believe that Soviet Russia desires war. From what I have seen of our Russian friends and allies during the war, I am convinced that there is nothing they admire so much as strength, and there is nothing for which they have less respect than for weakness, especially military weakness.
Okay, so we've probably all heard this Iron Curtain phrase before, and old Winston had hit it out of the park with this one, the term instantly becoming part of the vocabulary of the time, as well as enforcing this idea of an inevitable clash with the Western world and the Soviet Union. On top of someone coining the phrase Iron Curtain, there's another famous development in July of 1947, when the Long Telegram, otherwise known as the Sources of Soviet Conduct, these are titles of an article published in Foreign Affairs. The article by US policy analyst George Kennan, and written under the best pseudonym there has ever been, Mr. X, was influential in identifying the need to contain the USSR within its current borders through the use of US military, political, and economic power. Now, we don't need to overstate the importance of this one article. Kennan himself would later claim that it was generally misunderstood, but it stands as a marker for the idea of containment going forward. And it will mean that alarm bells are ringing when the next Cold War milestone arrives in 1949. As US foreign policy became focused on economic and political safeguards to the spread of communism, this also meant that Asia would need to be seen within a similar light, particularly as the US had occupied Japan. In the aftermath of the Second World War, China underwent, or I guess we could say resumed, its own terrible civil war. And it was in October of 1949 that Mao and the Chinese Communist Party declared victory and established the People's Republic of China. In December, Mao travelled to Moscow and negotiated a Sino-Soviet Treaty of Alliance. This was primarily a military agreement, and it committed the two communist sides to come to each other's aid if either of them was attacked by Japan, or, in quotation marks, any other state which should unite with Japan, meaning the United States, essentially. It's important to remember, like the US fears of another Pearl Harbor influencing certain defensive policy moves, so too were the USSR and China concerned with another war coming out of Germany, or Japan, respectively. The horror of the Second World War would be carried into the next period of international politics, just like the aftershocks of the First World War carried over to the Second. An oversimplification, to be sure, but something worth remembering. Now, the ramifications of China going red, as it was said, can't be understated. It is a massive blow to US interests and policymakers who see their project as one of, you know, ensuring peace and prosperity through the spread of capitalist markets and power. And naturally, seeing the very opposite of this happening fuels fears of a terrible red tide flowing across the rest of Asia. The communist bloc, as it were, seemingly doubled in size. And those who made it their purpose to halt that process are made to look a bit silly. Again, we're simplifying things here, but if we break it down to a basic realist view of international relations, based on power and territory, it's easy to understand a kind of panic on behalf of the US. They are still fearing the rearmament of Japan, or the threat of military action in Europe. It's a tense situation. Don't forget the atomic repercussions of all of this as well. The Soviet Union joined that particular dangerous club in 1949, just months before China goes communist. And another outcome of this Sino-Soviet alliance, both Stalin and Mao recognize Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam. People are starting to back their teams here, and with good reason. The ideologies which underpin both sides, the worldviews that these people are operating in. Well, both sides of the Cold War make it hard to find ground for mutual trust and appeasement. But importantly for our story, the First Indochina War takes on this new disguise, no longer about Southeast Asian national self-determination or neo-colonialism. Oh no, now the war was a battle for or against world communism, at least in the eyes of some of these new participants. Following the communist victory in China, and the subsequent backing of the DRV, Ho Chi Minh's forces could count on a, quote, vast and powerful friendly country as a reliable rear area. And over the next 2 years, this new ally began equipping and training North Vietnamese divisions capable of fighting large-scale open warfare. Philip Short states that from this point, the Viet Minh also drop the pretense that they are a purely nationalist force, and the idea that the whole of Indochina, or in other words, revolutionary movements in Cambodia and Laos as well, would also be a kind of strategic unity for the Indochinese Communist Party. This is how they're going to conceptualize it going forward. There's going to be a concerted effort to create a Democratic Republic of Indochina. This would incorporate all three territories, and they would serve as the vanguard of the communist revolution in Southeast Asia. This is a big deal. First, because it demonstrates the aim to create an alliance of states in opposition to the Indochinese Federation that the French Union was trying to implement. These are revolutionary counter-states, the Pathet Lao, or Lao Country, and Noko Khmer, or Khmer Land. This goes beyond just recruiting among the populations of these countries, but now they're setting up political parties there, along national lines. The other reason why this shift is important is because it goes hand in hand with the Vietnamese goal of independence. Basically, they are thinking that this independence is not going to be assured as long as Cambodia and Laos are not liberated. It's all or nothing. What started out as the Vietnamese war with the French is very soon going to become earning its title as the First Indochina War. It should be stressed, however, that although the Indochinese Communist Party was undergoing this change, this splitting up of the party into discrete groups at the Vietnamese Workers' Party, the Lao Independence Party, and the Revolutionary Cambodian People's Party. Essentially, despite this rebrand, I guess we could call it, I mean, all these parties are essentially still just staffed predominantly by Vietnamese. This is a Vietnamese initiative. In March of 1950, some of these developments are crystallized at a meeting of the Indochinese Communist Party leaders near Ha Tien in southern Vietnam. 45 Cambodians attended this meeting, and it was intended to set a path forward for the revolutions across Indochina. This Cambodian delegation was led by Son Yoc Minh, the former monk who we introduced as part of the Khmer Issarak in the last episode, who had become the first Cambodian formally accepted as a member of the Indochinese Communist Party. Thu Samut is also in attendance, and he was the monk who we saw escape and join the Viet Minh in the final stages of the Second World War in Indochina. The keynote speech was given by a Vietnamese communist in charge of Cambodian affairs, who analysed Cambodian society as he saw it, and estimated its prospects for revolution. The speech is analysed in both Chandler's Tragedy of Cambodian History and Short in his biography of Pol Pot, and it tells us a lot about some of the contradictions, as Chandler puts it, that those who would like to cultivate a communist revolution in Cambodia are going to have to cope with. One condition of Cambodian society that wasn't suited to revolutionary mobilization, or the phrase I've been using over the last few episodes, the conditions that would make cultivating that revolutionary energy easier. Well, I mean, there's a lack of an exploitative class of landlords, and by the same token, nothing resembling a large bourgeoisie class. There wasn't even a shortage of land. While there certainly were vast swathes of Cambodian peasants that are unhappy, these parts of the Cambodian population that had been left outside the modernizing developments of the French, even though they were not well suited, well, it's this group, this peasant group, they would end up being needed as the principal force of the revolution. And this will be because there was no industrial working class or proletariat to speak of. This is going to have to be an unorthodox Marxist-Leninist revolution. The Chinese communists had shown a way forward here, but we will sort of explore that a bit later. According to the Viet Minh analyst of Cambodian society, this group, this rural poor peasantry that was put forward as the class which would constitute the principal force of the revolution, well, he characterized them as diffuse, asleep, resistant to change, and lacking leadership, ideology, and organization. So even this class that is being earmarked as the, you know, future revolutionary bulk, well, even they are just not even in a very good position to be used to do that. The prospects for a successful revolution, as put forth in the speech, would first require Marxism-Leninism to be dispensed in the so-called evolved elements in Cambodia. Like the small intellectual class that was growing, at this stage it was still very much loyal to the Democratic Party, as we mentioned in the last episode. David Chandler expertly sets out what this speech meant at the time, but also how some of the plans as set out in it would also eventually foreshadow disaster. I'll quote him at length here. Son's plans, he's referring to who gave the speech, Nguyen Tan Son, Son's plans for the peasants and his optimism about them mingled contradictions and astute observations with wishful thinking. Without meaning to do so, Son forecast the disastrous trajectory that Cambodian communism was to follow for the next 3 decades, whereby a small intellectual elite pulled the poorest peasants not only into class warfare directed against the remainder of Cambodian society, but also toward an autarkic set of policies. This means a set of policies based on self-governance or independence mastery, as the Khmer Rouge will call it, a set of policies that led to a full-scale confrontation with Vietnam that was impossible to win. This trajectory was invisible in 1950, but prospects for a successful revolution were also difficult to discern. Cambodia's revolution began at Vietnamese insistence, without an indigenous proletariat or any communally organized grouping, aside from the Buddhist Sangha. There was also a shortage of trained and dedicated cadre. That shortage combined in a volatile manner with the perceived necessity of awakening Cambodian peasants to revolutionary violence. In the 1970s, when the inflammable mixture became a national policy, 1 in 4 Cambodians died as a result. In 1950, Son was buoyantly optimistic. He failed to see that the social ingredients for a Cambodian revolution were fraught with danger. He also took for granted that it would be subordinate to the revolution in Vietnam. Relatively advanced Cambodians, he thought, would absorb enough Marxism-Leninism to lead their compatriots along a path illuminated by Vietnam's more sophisticated struggle. End quote. Alright, so we've covered a fair bit here, but it's really important that we linger on this as well, because for a project like this series, where essentially we're trying to answer questions like, how did the Khmer Rouge come to power, and why did they do what they did? Well, you can start answering that question, if you're weird like me, by starting about 2,000 years in the past. But if we were going to at least do a thorough job in answering those questions, we should be starting around about in the 1950s, with these kinds of developments, especially at this juncture here, when the nationalist movement in Cambodia, embryonic in and of itself, is now being either merged with or sometimes set in opposition toward this kind of communist movement erupting in Vietnam. What this all means as the 1950s begin is that the Vietnamese have realized the need to incorporate Cambodia and Laos into their plans for independence. As the Vietnamese movement is led by communists, and therefore governed by certain frameworks defined by Marxist-Leninist thought, there becomes a need to also export this ideology to these other peoples, regardless of the suitability. In the case of Cambodia, although there were levels of discontent and perhaps at least some level of desire to get rid of the French, those conditions may not translate perfectly to a revolution based on Marxist-Leninist thinking. This process would be made more difficult when we consider the kind of hierarchy that the Vietnamese seem to think was inherent in that process, that they would be the arbiter of the Cambodian movement. But how do you react to that as a Cambodian, with the idea of the Vietnamese as hereditary enemy still lodged somewhere within that cultural consciousness? It's like the Vietnamese are trying to teach the Cambodians how to ride a bike. They think riding a bike is extremely important, and the Cambodians need to be riding this bike even if they've never seen a bike before. And this bike has all these complicated gears and brakes, it's hard to get your leg over it, but that doesn't matter. The Vietnamese will be able to guide them, because they consider themselves naturally adept at this kind of thing. So they've got training wheels on there and all the other bells and whistles, and the hope is that one day the training wheels will be able to be removed, and the Cambodians will ride the bike in the direction that they are told. But in these early days, everything needs to be micromanaged, and the Vietnamese aren't able to delegate anything meaningful to the Khmer because they lack the training. And if we are stretching this metaphor, well, let's stretch it right out, shall we? When the Cambodians eventually kick off the training wheels and ride this bike as fast as they can to try and get out in front of the Vietnamese, well, they're going to end up flying right off of a cliff. But that's about 25 years down the track. In the early 1950s, we are still just talking about trying to get these new oppositional revolutionary states to function as some kind of viable alternative to French colonial rule. Trying to get this Khmer land, as they were calling it, up and running, is going to prove frustrating for the Vietnamese. Philip Short goes over this frustration with the training wheels phase when he says, quote, "To the Vietnamese, it seemed that no matter how hard they tried to mobilize Khmer support, the overwhelming majority of Cambodians stubbornly refused to budge. A senior Viet Minh general complained that it was impossible to find Cambodian officer material because they lack qualities of command. In 1951, despite a recruitment drive and a decision to lower membership criteria for Khmers to take account of the insufficiency of their intellectual level," but that was him quoting a Vietnamese, "there were still only 150 Khmer Party members. The Vietnamese, like the French before them, had decided that the Cambodians were apathetic, primitive, and incapable of doing anything without the tutelage of a more civilized and rigorous power." End quote. Now, how does this influence from Vietnam mix with some of the developments we spoke about in the last episode, with the Khmer Issarak, or for Cambodian politics? Various sources point out that up to one-third of Cambodian territory is out of the hands of the Phnom Penh government by 1950, and the opposition to that government is solidified at a First National Congress of Khmer Resistance, held a few months after that speech, which laid out the prospects for revolution in Cambodia, naturally the speech held in Vietnam. This Congress, however, this Congress of Khmer Resistance, well, this was a meeting up not just with Khmer communists, but also with the Khmer Issarak. So it's not just the Indo-Chinese Communist Party running this one. We've got Free Khmer as well, looking to gain independence, and they're joining into this, I guess we could say, kind of coalition to further that aim. At this meeting between all of these parties, they decided upon the formation of a kind of independence association, essentially a kind of proto-government. That might be overstating it, but that was the thrust of the meeting. They even adopted a flag, the Issarak flag. It featured a yellow, five-towered image of Angkor Wat on a red background. One that will be very similar to the flag of Democratic Kampuchea about 25 years later. Now, at this associated Khmer Freedom Alliance, let's sort of call it that, you do have people like Son Yeok-min and Thu Samut. They're obviously in attendance, and Son Yeok-min is actually the head of the committee here. Now, even though it's not a completely communist organization, it does mean that the alliance of the Khmer Issarak movement at this time was led by those connected to the Indo-Chinese Communist Party. But some of you who listened to the last episode might be wondering, what happened to the other Issarak that were dominating the scene previously? What happened to the magical warlord, Dap Chuan? What about the rebel prince, Chantarangzi? Why aren't they there? Well, to tie up the rest of the picture here before we check back into the study circles in Paris, we need to quickly check in with King Sihanouk and trace some of the moves that he has been making to solidify rule in what he would consider to be his kingdom. In the last episode, I tried to go into some of the complexities of the term Issarak, because it is not something that defines one particular group, movement, army, or ideology. It's more a banner that many different leaders, bandits, revolutionaries, warlords, and dissidents will claim to be working under, at times in coalitions, alliances, and at others working against each other, or against the Viet Minh, or the French, or somewhat confusingly, they'll work with the French as well. I think it would be next to impossible for me to be able to, in this format, give a thorough breakdown of the different factions, leaders, and interactions between all those under this Issarak banner from the early 1940s into the mid-1950s. But that difficulty, in and of itself, kind of gets across the point that I want. The Khmer independence movement, in the years after World War II, and indeed up until the country's independence in 1954, it's a hot mess. I mean, just before, for instance, we were talking about one Issarak alliance, and that one alliance was declaring itself essentially an independent state, with its leadership being primarily those associated with the Viet Minh. But that is just one alliance, and it occurs in 1950. As we explained in the last episode, leading up to that, I guess, halfway point in the First Indochina War, most of the Issarak activity in Cambodia was stemming from those supported by Thailand, not Vietnam. And there would be Issarak of that persuasion who would hate nothing more than seeing more Vietnamese influence in Cambodia. We also have to mention that so-called legitimate political movements in this mix, like the Democratic Party, or indeed the actions of King Sihanouk himself, who are also trying to achieve independence for Cambodia via different means. Ben Kiernan includes a map of Cambodia in his book How Pol Pot Came to Power, and it shows, with different lines and shading, all these different zones and areas that were essentially out of control of the French and the government in Phnom Penh. Areas where it was not advisable to travel through without being attacked by these Issarak, let alone, you know, try and procure taxes in these places. So we have a scenario where Cambodia is broken up with some leaders in some areas doing one thing or another. And a good example of that is our magical warlord from the Kulen Mountains, the former sergeant Dap Chuan. He had been carving out a following in the northwest of Cambodia since the end of the Second World War. And although he had been the Issarak leader with the biggest faction, he did not last long in the various alliances between these powerful Issarak leaders. He was seen as too authoritarian. He was ruthless. At one point in 1949, he summons two other Issarak leaders to his headquarters just to have them assassinated. His style alienates others in the broad coalition of freedom fighters, and it is not long before this magical warlord, looking primarily to bolster his own position and create a kind of personal fiefdom, well, he begins reaching out in secret to the French to, you know, organize some kind of arrangement out of this predicament. In the last episode, in part one, I tried to set up this analogy between the generalized view of the Issarak movement to something akin to organized crime in a nation state we might be familiar with today. Perhaps because I've been re-watching The Sopranos during all these lockdowns, but while I admit it isn't a perfect comparison, the idea of these different groups with an organized crime network who, you know, sometimes oppose each other, sometimes work together, but they have a general set of values that are just outside of what a state is trying to do, you know, and they can also rely on violence to achieve certain aims, while also involving themselves in communities, recruiting, even taking on some functions of a state, like taxation, protection of citizens in return for certain other things, or spreading certain ideologies. I feel like it kind of works. This metaphor is kind of there. It's not perfect, I'll admit that, but it's something. And in this instance, if we compare, you know, the Sopranos to the Issarak, well, we have one of the massive, you know, crime bosses, if we want to put it that way, defecting to the FBI in return for a level of protection. These developments occur at around the same time that Sihanouk is also beginning to negotiate marginal gains in Cambodian independence from France. At this early stage in 1949, these provisions of independence from the neo-colonial power were, well, not that much. But it does show that there is some movement on the issue, coming in that very official capacity from state to king, if we want to put it that way. And it also proves that there could be different directions from which independence could come. Above, below, east, or west. And in September 1949, in what David Chandler calls an impressively staged ceremony in the parklands of Angkor Thom, well, Dap Chuan emerges from his forest headquarters and, with 400 men in tow, pledges allegiance to Sihanouk. And in return for not being part of the Issarak anymore, well, Chuan receives administrative and military carte blanche over Siem Reap, allowing him to have his own little sector just like he wanted. This is someone who, 3 years earlier, had led a band of militants into Siem Reap and attacked French forces And now he's going to be afforded a role by the same administration he had previously been working to destroy. Those of you familiar with later periods of Cambodian history may find that little story quite familiar. So what does this all mean for us going forward? Well, Dap Chuan's defection, among a few other leaders as well, leaves the ISRAK movement weakened, but at the same time open to more influence coming from the East and the Viet Minh. Meanwhile, the country's legitimate political process was not making much headway after the most popular party, the Democrats, were reduced to similar levels of infighting and factionalism as the ISRAK. This was compounded by the events in January of 1950, when the Democrats' leader, Eo Kuus, was fatally wounded after a grenade was rolled into the party headquarters by an assassin. The possibility that the Democrats could recover was slim, considering they had already lost their most qualified politician, Prince Yuttevong, soon after he had founded the party a few years earlier. By this time, Sihanouk was making moves toward going around the Democrats, whom both he and the French distrusted completely, and the political process had failed to make much progress toward independence, or much progress in general, in a country that was divided at this time between bandits, warlords, ISRAK with allegiance to the Viet Minh, or otherwise, as well as splintered government forces. There was no clear leader in the race toward independence, and much of the countryside became outside of the direct influence of Phnom Penh. But while there was no one out front in this race toward independence, it appeared that the finish line itself was approaching, like the race itself was being shortened, without those running taking that many strides forward. The war in Vietnam, now with the Chinese, Soviets, and United States involved, would soon create conditions where change would become more likely, combined with the fact that French authorities were at least beginning to grant token amounts of independence to components of Indochina. Sihanouk was keenly aware of this, and so too were the Cambodian intellectual elite, represented by the students who were studying in Paris, Salut Sa included, who would begin developing their own opinions on how that change should take shape. And they would begin consulting with a character in our story who, theoretically at least, might have what it takes to unite the independence movement in Cambodia. A man who is often credited with the birth of the nationalist movement. Currently still in house arrest in France, after his failed attempts at claiming Cambodia's independence in the wake of the Japanese surrender in World War II. Son Nhoc Tan. Walking toward the intersection of the Rue de Commerce and Rue Letellier, Salut Sa, now in his mid-twenties, held a mixture of books under one arm. As he approached the room he rented above a wine shop and cafe. By the start of 1951, Sa had completed the first year of his studies at the Radio Electricity School in Paris, having been allocated a scholarship to study there following his vocational studies back in Phnom Penh. By this time, he had become rather uninterested in the subject he was supposed to be engaged in. He spent a lot of time reading and hanging out with the other Cambodian students. This following a summer holiday in Yugoslavia, where he had witnessed and participated in the massive labor brigades reconstructing the country. He was returning to the room he rented by means of his introduction to one of the elder brothers, if we can put it that way, of the small Cambodian community living in Paris. Keng Van Sak, the highly intelligent, if slightly eccentric, linguist and scholar of Cambodian literature. Van Sak himself lived relatively close to Sir, not far from the Eiffel Tower, and the older brother had recently begun organizing kinds of informal study sessions at his apartment, along with the other head of the Khmer Student Association, and similarly grandiose intellectual from a very wealthy family, Tion Mum. Sa was walking home from one of these study circles, feeling just slightly out of his depth. Many of the other participants were university students. Some were preparing their PhDs, while he had until recently been studying carpentry and only held a middle school certificate. Nevertheless, he found these sessions fascinating and had begun attending them due to his friendship with another Cambodian student, Yang Sari. Sari, as we explained in the previous episode, was something of a classic intellectual and had been involving himself as a young person into the political scene in Phnom Penh during his later years of study at the prestigious Lycée Sisowat, before receiving a scholarship to study in Paris. He and his friend Rat Somwen had also began absorbing themselves with the rudiments of Marxist teachings before arriving in France, and continued that path by getting in touch with a student union with ties to the Communist Party. Ironically, the guy who acted as an intermediary there between the Cambodian students and these left-wing groups was a half-French, half-Vietnamese named Jacques Vergès, a law student who would, more than 60 years later, and after a controversial career to say the least, become Khieu Samphan's defense counsel at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. But perhaps we're getting ahead of ourselves slightly, aren't we? So, at this relatively early stage in Paris, this group of students that gathered every now and again at Van Sack's apartment were more or less just doing what university students do. A gathering of friends and like-minded people who, according to Van Sack, in one way or another, regarded themselves as progressive. Now, I apologize to any students listening. I too was like you. But there can be a tendency to intellectualize and pontificate that just goes hand in hand with being of a certain age and in a certain frame of mind. Now, let's add that tendency, as we'll call it, to the other context here that requires some attention. The Khmer students in Paris saw themselves as intellectuals, not just because they were students, and that's what some students do, but also because they saw themselves as forming something above their compatriots back in Cambodia, a kind of elitism, I guess we could say. I mean, after all, this is the cream of the crop, so to speak. They had been afforded this incredibly rare status of being sent to study abroad. As David Chandler says, it would be just a small step for them to go further and see themselves as a vanguard for their country, a small group that could guide everyone unable to grasp the kinds of subjects they were considering in these meetings that they were regularly having. As Salazar turned on the lamp in his small room, overlooking a street which would, in modern times, become known as one of the best stretches of shopping in Paris, he pondered some of the discussion which had been laid out earlier in the night. The political focus of the session had been about the three distinct pro-independence movements at work in their native country. The original Khmer Issarakes, led by local warlords like we've discussed, Dapchuan, Puchai, Prince Chaturangzi, and others. Then there were the so-called Khmer Viet Minh, which was the term used by the French to describe Issarak leaders and those other Cambodians who had come under the influence of the Vietnamese, like Son Yoc Minh and Thu Samut. And lastly, they discussed the possible sway that the Cambodian parliament and the uneasy relationship that their king had with it and the ruling Democratic Party, who were looking to, you know, transform independence within the French Union into independence in and of itself via negotiations with France. You've got these different parties, these different methods, these different ways forward, different paths, I guess we could say. All of the students present at this study session at Keng Vang Sak's apartment, well, they had said how important they felt gaining independence was. And this is no surprise, considering the context they found themselves in. France's dirty war in Indochina was becoming increasingly unpopular by this point. And the French left that many students found themselves in was extremely anti-colonial. Elsewhere, the communist victory in China and independence movements in Indonesia and India made this issue paramount for students who considered themselves, quite rightly I suppose, to be the future intellectual elite of Cambodia. Despite much of the discussion that night having devolved into the kinds of chatter that you might expect a group of 20-something-year-old university students having in their Parisian apartment about how they think the world should be run, well, a distinction could be made between two broad opinions on display about the subject of independence. Salazar, like many students his age, had maintained a kind of adoration for a figure like Son Yoc Tan, a man they saw as the literal political salvation for their country, someone who could potentially return like Christ and carry Cambodia toward independence, unifying the Issarak and deposing Sihanouk, who they saw as just a puppet of the French. Saw had sided with a couple of other like-minded students when this question came up, Hung Thun Hak and Er Sichao. Thun Hak would one day become prime minister, but we should say for a quite small amount of time, in Lon Nol's Khmer Republic. He will eventually be executed the day after the fall of Phnom Penh, while the other student there, Er Sichao, we will see later on in this episode, he's going to be involved rather closely with Son Yoc Tan. Anyway, he's in this, you know, he's in agreement with these guys who are supportive of Son Yoc Tan being the way forward, I guess we could say. Now, their side was in disagreement with those students that didn't think that Son Yoc Tan, the nationalist, was the answer, but rather that an alliance with the Viet Minh, or at least following their example, would be vital for Cambodia's independence. This was led by Yang Sari and Rat Samoan, who were now feeling their way into communism as a means of national liberation. As we explained in the last episode, this was also during a time when, particularly in Paris, communism seemed to be the wave of the future. Over the course of about a year, these study sessions at Van Sack's apartment, I would say they began to transform from just discussions, students getting together and arguing about what they think, into more motivated, committed, and even heated exchanges. Generally speaking, the split between those who believed Son Yat-chan was the answer and those who thought communism was the answer, well, that divide would widen, particularly after those sympathetic to the communist side attended a student festival in Berlin in the August of 1951. This World Youth Festival for Peace was more of a front for communist organizations to attract these kinds of left-wing student groups across the globe, I guess we could say, to one place. And the leaders that the Khmer Student Association, alerted to the festival by Jacques Vergès, decided to send some delegates along. Yang Sari was first in line, and Keng Van Sack was one of the unofficial elders of the Paris students, who recalled angrily that while he assumed he was going to be going along with them, he had actually been excluded in a demonstration of the political split that was happening in these study circles. I'll quote Philip Short's book as he quotes the fuming Van Sack. Quote, "They screwed me. They didn't get my papers. The day we were supposed to leave, I couldn't go because I had no passport, no visa. Why? Because they wanted to get rid of me, to push me aside. They saw that I wasn't a hardliner like they were. I thought too much. I didn't act pig-headedly in a fanatical, extremist way. And I had friends among the Tarnists like Er Sichao and Hung Tun Hak. Ingsari himself told me later, 'You are too sensitive. You'll never be a politician. To do politics, you have to be tough. You can't do it, brother. You are too sentimental.'" End quote. Now, this goes a little way in explaining what we will begin to see later, but I included that just so we could get a little more of an insight into Yang Sari, the student, the attitudes at play here, how grandiose they considered what they were doing was, as well as the ambition. And again, you can't necessarily blame them either. Those familiar with the Khmer Rouge will have no doubt come across some explanation of the movement, being led by at least some degree by a core of students who had studied in Paris. I think tracing the evolution of that is, while perhaps a little meandering to get through, quite important. These students in their mid-20s are put in this position to consider themselves very important to the future of their country. And the shift from just talking about it to taking action about it, that's quite important. And this festival in Berlin that they're going to, there is certainly a change afterwards. First of all, the students that attend, already sympathetic to what the Viet Minh were doing in the war against France, well, at this student festival, the Cambodian delegates get to meet those members from Vietnam, and they learn for the first time about how Cambodians are joining the fight. They learn about Son Yat-min, who up until this point, these Khmer students had only heard about in rumors. They even get a photo of him and some pamphlets and the Khmer Land flag. All of a sudden, the path seems available to travel. The possibility of actually joining this independence movement seems like a realistic possibility. the big decision that comes from this, as the Cambodian delegation excitedly returned to Paris, was that the Khmer would have to also take up an armed struggle against the French. The example that the Viet Minh had set was the only way to get independence, and the communist way of doing this would be the best route to force the French out of Indochina. Now, Salot Sar, he didn't go to this student festival. He wasn't part of this new fervour for that communist side of things. At the time, he was on the Son Yoke-Tan side of the equation anyway, if we're talking about that split in the student study sessions. But that particular summer holiday anyway, while they had gone to Berlin to this communist youth festival, Salot Sar had chose to again go back to Yugoslavia, this time on a camping trip, doing a little less manual labour. Now, at this early juncture, it very much seems like Yang Sari was the driving force of the communist cause in the student group in Paris. And those informal study sessions at Kang Van Sack's apartment, well, soon that eccentric linguist would be returning home to Cambodia. And it will be Yang Sari who takes the responsibility of continuing these meetings of young student minds. However, these meetings would be done under a new name, the Cercle Marxiste. And the Paris student group, once divided between those who saw Son Yoke-Tan as the answer and those that saw independence via communist armed struggle, well, this direction will also be influenced by the actions of the former Prime Minister himself. He, the leader of the initial nationalist independence movements in the Second World War, well, he'd been imprisoned by the French soon after they came back to claim their colonial possession. He was considered a troublemaker and sentenced to house arrest in France for his role in collaborating with the Imperial Japanese. Naturally, the French wanted to avoid any massive backlash by, you know, executing the highly popular Cambodian, but also didn't want him just to be in the country so that he might act as a reminder or symbol of that nationalist movement that needed to be, you know, repressed in order for the French to keep their interests first and foremost. In France, Son Yoke-Tan had studied law, and on occasion, the intellectual elite represented by those Khmer students studying in Paris had come to visit him. What I think is one of the more important encounters between the students and Tan came about in September of 1951. This is just about a month after the Khmer Student Association delegation had returned from that communist youth festival. Well, Tion Mum and Yang Sari, both representing the, I'm just going to start calling it communist, side of the student association, they came to Son Yoke-Tan and presented this scenario to him, suggesting that an armed struggle must be the way forward, especially now that there was a Cambodian element of the Viet Minh working toward that same goal back home. Or that perhaps Tan himself, maybe he should endorse this movement, and that communism as this wave of the future as they saw it might be able to rid their country of the French and the puppet king Sihanouk. So Mum and Sari have this conversation with Tan. However, the former prime minister does not commit to anything. Somewhat disappointingly for these students, riding this excitement after their experience meeting with the Viet Minh delegates the month earlier. They see this genuine path forward, and they invite this massive figure in Cambodian politics to travel it with them. But the great man does not follow. He will not endorse their idea of armed struggle. At some point during their discussion, and I'm going to imagine it occurs at some point after Tan says something like, "I'm sorry, boys, I just don't see it that way." Something along those lines, you know? And he offers them some tea or coffee and walks off to the kitchen. That's when Sari and Mum look at each other, somewhat annoyed at having heard their ideas rebuffed. And one of them notices that sitting quite prominently on the bookshelf in the living room is the collected works of Karl Marx, an item sure to catch the attention of students of that persuasion. So Sari approached the shelf, pulls out the weighty tome, and notices that it has the rigidness of a book that has never been opened. Its spine thoroughly uncracked. The pages are prim and pristine, and they look at each other once more with clear disapproval, holding this obvious evidence of Tan's ignorance of the situation. And now they knew why he wouldn't see what they did. What was clear to the students who have seen the truth. A moment, something like thinking, "Now, wait a second, I know more than my parents do." That you can't rely on these figures who were supposed to have been in charge. They will not completely dismiss Tan as a political force, but perhaps this will simply reinforce their ideas that they will need to be the vanguard of any possible revolution. Now, Tan has plans of his own, plans that would have meant it was completely improper for him to have, endorsed an armed struggle at the behest of, some students that rocked up at his door one day. For months, he had been in negotiation with Sihanouk and the French to return to Cambodia. The French no longer saw him as a threat, and Sihanouk, whose motives are slightly less obvious, had requested that Tan return as well. If he had gone along with these idealistic students, even having made only just a slight pronouncement that would have exposed any political ambitions to those that were interested and following what he was doing closely back in Cambodia, just weeks before coming back, after 6 years in exile, this would have been ill-advised. Mum and Sari returned to Paris from Tan's residence in Poitiers, a fairly long journey. They are emboldened now to disregard any claims that the so-called Tanists of their student groups have shared about the path toward independence. And subsequently, the Khmer students in the capital who are engaged in this question will have their politics shifted further toward the left, the effects of which we will return to shortly. But the return of Sonyok Tan to Cambodia, the nationalist hero thought to be of use somehow to Sihanouk, or by some measure just some spent political force in the eyes of the French, well, that is what we need to follow just for a moment, because the former Prime Minister has a little something going on that will end up shaking up the political scene in Cambodia quite a lot. On the afternoon of October 29th, Sonyok Tan arrived by aeroplane to Phnom Penh. Coincidentally, earlier that day, another example of the kind of general turmoil that was going on in the country had taken place. During an afternoon siesta, a high-ranking French official, Commissioner Jean de Raymond, was assassinated. According to David Chandler, it was likely that the Vietnamese houseboy, who was employed by the French official, had actually been planted there by the Viet Minh. And the reason for this particular method was to take advantage of de Raymond's, quote, allegedly bizarre sexual tastes. The Viet Minh agent had snuck into the room and stabbed and hammered the official to death, before making an escape and finding eventual refuge in Vietnam. So, yeah, not exactly smooth sailing for the French in Indochina. Anyway, later that day, Son Yuk-tan arrives, and this was not the subtle reintroduction of a spent political force, as some may have been expecting. The 6-mile trip from the airport to Phnom Penh took more than an hour, something that visitors to Cambodia today might experience more just for traffic reasons, but this was different. The roadside in 1951 was crowded by some 100,000 supporters who carried banners like Son Yuk-tan, Our Hope, and Son Yuk-tan, National Hero. Needless to say, Sihanouk was not very impressed. Now, we might just assume that with this kind of support, the former Prime Minister kept his car going all the way to the Cambodian parliament, and that the Democratic Party would dust off a seat in some high-powered position, no? Well, soon after his arrival, they did welcome him back and offered him the post of Minister of Foreign Affairs. But Tan refused, saying that, no, he lacked that kind of ambition. A few months later, he would say that he had been gone for so long, and he just wished to continue having conversations with all the different elements as a private citizen in the country once again. But by January of 1952, Tan was back to his old game in the newspaper business, starting another magazine, this time titled Khmer Krauk, or Khmer's Awake, a message that had been regularly shared in Nagaravata in the late 1930s. But this new magazine was much more forthright in its anti-French, pro-Cambodian independence message. This new newspaper was shut down within a month. By this time, Tan had also been the recipient of a substantial amount of back pay that covered the salary he would have earned in the Indochinese civil service in the roughly 6 years or so since his arrest and return to Phnom Penh. Tan was cooking up a little plan and remained conspicuously outside of the official political process at this time. Then, on the 9th of March, 1952, 7 years to the day after the Japanese coup against the French, he made his move. On what was officially supposed to be an inspection of customs facilities on the Thai border, Tan and a handful of faithful followers, including Ia Sichau, the former regular of the student study sessions in Paris, drove out from Phnom Penh. When their convoy did not arrive in the northwest that night, well, the assumption for several days was that they were just kidnapped by Issarak guerrillas in the countryside. I mean, when two-thirds or whatever it was at this time of the country's territory is essentially outside of the government hand, makes sense, doesn't it? Except that wasn't quite what had happened. rather, Tan had met, rather cordially, with a prominent Issarak leader north of Siem Reap, and had joined the Marquis, the French term being appropriated for these rural guerrilla bases, which carries this connotation of revolutionaries moving into the jungle to join the resistance. We're going to use this term quite a bit going forward. This is a big deal as well. First, because it was an attempt to unify Cambodia's anti-colonial movement by one of the most well-supported figures in the country. It is also interesting because it now became obvious that joining the Issarak was Tan's intention the whole time, even before he returned to Cambodia. And his, you know, playing it cool with those students in Paris was an attempt to keep a low profile long enough to be allowed to return by the French and Sihanouk. The other reason this is a big event is the effect that it will have on the already fragile politics of the country and the king. Sihanouk, as we've seen, has a fairly high opinion of himself, and he wants independence too, but his way. A way that would ensure his power and reinforce the image of his country and his people. Not only had he been made to look foolish by Tan, because Sihanouk had, in a sense, you know, vouched for his return to the French, and, well, now look at this guy. After getting that massive crowd to cheer his return, by the way, well, now he's joining the Issarak and calling for an end to the monarchy? This is going to create waves. As Milton Osborne writes in his biography of the Cambodian king, quote, "Indeed, if one seeks a single factor that above all others contributed to Sihanouk's transformation from dilettante politician to a ruler committed both to gaining independence and to ensuring that he alone held the reins of power within Cambodia, Tan's affront would be that factor." End quote. What I am trying to set up here, and I guess this has been going on for a few episodes, is the massive role that Sihanouk is going to play going forward. His role, at least what he can advertise as his role in gaining independence, is really important down the track when we talk about the Khmer Rouge solidifying their own rise to power, as will be the particular style of rule that he ends up employing and the management of Cambodia leading into that period as well. Remember, up until this point, and since the end of the Second World War, there had been an attempt to have a functioning political system in the kingdom, with voting and parties, you know, all that normal stuff. The Democrats had stood out as the prime candidates, and were trying to gain independence and carry the flame of the original Cambodian nationalists, Son Yoc Tan being the most prominent of those figures. The fact that Tan had chosen to sidestep that political process and join the Issarak highlighted the idea that progress was not likely to be made in that legitimate arena, if we want to call it that. And now, after a period of intermittent sulking or raging, according to Osborne, Sihanouk was going to react in a way that effectively ended this attempt at a pluralistic political system in Cambodia. In effect, what would happen if a president or prime minister or queen or whatever it may be in a modern context said, "You know what, enough of these political parties and stuff like that, I'm just going to be the leader, okay? Just me, alright?" This is even though Tan had barely been able to get like 300 people to join him in his jungle resistance. Mostly young idealistic students, not battle-ready hardstuffs. You know, his actions were seen as treasonous. But the Democratic Party in Phnom Penh, already seen as unreliable and subversive by both the French and Sihanouk, well, They also refused to go and, you know, send security forces to try and apprehend Tan. There was a period of chaos for a few months as, even though Tan failed to actually unify the Issarak elements into a force capable of effecting any change, as, you know, many people hoped he would be able to, all these factions and different allegiances within that broad banner, Tan wasn't able to bring it together. But during this, you know, period of turmoil, there were student protests and even some general anti-French, anti-government protests around the kingdom. Amidst this period of unrest, Sihanouk made a pointed speech that would give us an indication of what he was going to do next. And I'll quote some of it at length here, as the now 30-year-old king began properly entering the political arena. Quote, "I can no longer stand by and watch my country drown and my people die. Over these last few months, we have no longer dared look each other in the face. In our offices and schools, everywhere people are discussing politics, suspecting each other, hatching plots, promoting this person, bringing down that one, pushing the third aside, doing no constructive work. While in the country at large, killing, banditry, and murder hold sway. Chaos reigns. The established order has ceased to exist. The military and the police no longer know where their duty lies. The Issaraks are told they are dying for Cambodia, and so are our soldiers dying in the battle against them. Each day threatens to engulf us in a veritable civil war. This is how things now stand, gentlemen. The time has come for the nation to make clear whether it desires to follow the way of the rebels or to continue in the path that I have traced." End quote. Both the French and Sihanouk seized on this opportunity to make a move against the Democrats, the French affording Sihanouk the kind of armed backing to do so as well. Now, the king, he was citing residual powers in the constitution, which states that all power emanates from his position, and he dismissed the Democrat government, declared himself prime minister on the 15th of June, 1952. He named a new cabinet, made up of only trusted allies. And this was the beginning of what Sihanouk himself called a royal crusade for independence. While still aiming for a somewhat amicable relationship with France, he promised independence for Cambodia within 3 years. And this kind of promise caused confusion for those who had joined the resistance in the countryside. Kind of like, imagine being in a heated argument with someone for a long time, and then they suddenly say, "Oh yeah, no, I agree with you on that. Yeah, that fundamental point that had previously been impossible to compromise on. Yeah, no, I'll do that." Essentially, Sihanouk had staged a coup and announced himself as a contender in the path to independence. He was now going to take on this role of neutralizing his political opponents and gaining concessions from the French directly. And he was in a very unique position to be able to do so. Remember a few episodes ago when we spoke about how the French had used the position of king as a means of keeping control over the rest of the country. The more they increased his visibility and popularity, by the same token, their means of controlling the people was bolstered. It's like the French had built up this institution as the embodiment of a national identity and enhanced the position with power that they assumed would always be effective only in ways that they decided it would be. But what happens when the king breaks out of the cage that you have built for him? Suddenly those powers, which before were taken for granted as just being symbolic or ceremonial, now they become very real. And the predominantly rural population of Cambodia, who saw the king as a semi-divine being, well, that is a power that can achieve a great deal for good and bad. As we will see over the next quarter of a century in this story. David Chandler says in Tragedy of Cambodian History, quote, "The French probably thought that they had helped him sweep the Democrats aside, and that he, Sihanouk, would abide by their glacial timetable for relinquishing control. This was a serious miscalculation." End quote. Son Yat-Thanh's decision to join the ISRAK, or what he sort of rebranded his segment of that movement, the Khmer Serai, Free Khmer, and the subsequent months of turmoil before Sihanouk dissolved the parliament and declared himself prime minister, well, these shockwaves coming out of Cambodia were naturally of consequence to the students looking on from Paris. The period between Thanh's return to Cambodia in the last quarter of 1951 to roughly midway through 1952 with Sihanouk's coup, well, this also roughly overlaps with the transformation of the student study groups into something more committed to the communist movement. As we saw, some of those students who considered themselves Thanhists had actually returned to Cambodia and joined him in the Marquise. But a combination of Ieng Sary, Tion Mum, and Rat Samwen, they were more interested in using Marxism to bring about change in Cambodia. And they were going to effect that change across the student association in Paris. Philip Short describes a kind of testing of the waters here, where about 30 progressive students were convened, and there was a big chat about the struggle for independence in Cambodia. Now, no one was saying the word communism out loud, you know, we're not going to scare anyone off. But from there, in this, you know, interview kind of format that these students weren't quite aware of, some of them had contact made afterwards about this new secret organization, the aforementioned Cercle Marxiste. This is where we splinter off into a proper, secretive, Leninist-influenced organization trying to effect revolution. Here is Philip Short describing the structure of the Cercle Marxiste. Quote, "It was built up of individual cells, each comprising between 3 and 6 people. It was rigidly compartmentalized. One member of each cell was in contact with a single member of the leadership, and no cell member knew who belonged to the other cells or how many cells existed. Years later, some members were still unsure who had really been in charge. The cells met once a week, usually for a couple of hours in the evening, to discuss the week's events and to study Marxist texts. They started with Lenin's ABC of Communism, followed by the Communist Manifesto and Mao Zedong's On New Democracy. There were also evenings of criticism and self-criticism, when cell members analysed their shortcomings and those of their comrades." End quote. Now, we don't actually have all of the biographical details here that will make this all quite seamless and neat, but sometime after Son Yat-Thanh had returned to Cambodia, toward the end of 1951, in the 9 months or so after that, Salat Sar began wondering what he was going to do with his life. After all, he was failing at the radio electricity school. His political hero, Tan, who he had met on occasion, he was now gone. And it's around this time that contact is made with him to join the Cercle Marxiste. And this was going to give him a purpose. Again, we're not quite sure exactly when this occurs, but we have other dates that we can work around here. So, roughly speaking, half a year or so between Sar joining the Cercle and Sihanouk's declaration of his crusade for independence midway through 1952, we can get a pretty good look at how his political views have developed in that time. Because he writes a piece in the Cambodian Student newsletter that decries the king's actions. It was titled Monarchy or Democracy, and it was published under the pseudonym Khmer Daeum, or Original Khmer. And even that choice seems to say something to his desire to claim some kind of authentically Cambodian position. But we can also take a lot from some of the ideas he presents in what Short describes as a juvenile effort, compared to some of the other pieces of writing coming from the more academically advanced members of the Cercle or the student association at large. But still, very much worth having a look at it, because this is the first time in the series that we can actually access a primary source written by the man who would one day become Pol Pot. This is essentially him speaking to us for the first time in the show, so let's explore that. Basically, the piece starts with a complaint about what the king has done, saying that it was an injustice to dissolve the government, that he is destroying the interests of the Cambodian people. Salat Sar then defines monarchy and says that, quote, "History shows us that since our country has existed, we have always been dominated and exploited by the monarchy. The condition of the people is degraded to that of the animal, considered a herd of slaves, forced to work tirelessly, night and day, to feed the absolute monarchy and its harem of courtiers." End quote. I mean, that's a bit interesting because it kind of gives us that basic Marxist view of seeing history in an economic frame and as a class of people being exploited by another. Interesting that Sar gives us that little insight into a harem as well, as we know that he had first-hand experience within that area of the royal palace when he was in his teens. Sar also emphasizes the negative impact that monarchy has on Buddhism specifically, going as far to say that it has destroyed Buddhism to an extent. Which is fascinating, first because he is not following a Marxist tone there, which would more or less dismiss religion as one of a few tools of the exploiting class. He goes on to say that the Buddha himself abandoned the monarchy to embrace a truth which would enrich people's lives. Again, interesting for how we compare this attitude to the eventual stance that the Khmer Rouge will take on Buddhism. But at this stage, another clue that he is looking at these problems with Cambodia through a Cambodian lens, as well as having these other Western influences on his thought. This is reinforced when he states that, quote, "History shows us that these two regimes, democracy and monarchy, always oppose each other, and that peace cannot be established until the monarchy is gone. The 1789 revolution in France, under the leadership of Robespierre and Danton, dissolved the monarchy and executed King Louis XVI. the 1917 revolution in Russia, with Lenin and Stalin as guides, completely abolished the monarchy. The revolution of 1924 in China, the people being under the direction of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, abolished the monarchy and the whole imperial family. End quote. Again, here we see the influences on the left-wing students in Paris. The French Revolution, the communist victory in China and Russia. Have I mentioned the historical hurricane on this show before? Another point of interest to include here in a foreshadowing kind of way is when he says, quote, "Monarchy is an unjust doctrine, as infectious as putrid plague. Humanity must abolish it." End quote. The use of this kind of body imagery or medical kinds of terms, which could also be translated from the French as foul as a putrefying sore. Well, it's this kind of language he will employ in his speeches and instructions as leader of Democratic Kampuchea, when identifying the enemies of the Cambodian Revolution that will also, one day, need to be abolished. Just to wrap up his writing about Sihanouk's so-called coup, well, Tsar's thoughts about it, anyway, I think in this earliest thing we have to go off of for him, and looking at potential clues to a young Pol Pot's mindset, we also get a look in at what will end up being very big questions about the Khmer Rouge regime in general, and what were the central goals of that regime. Now, one of the big divisions in the scholarship of the Khmer Rouge is this question about just how communist they really were, and just how much it was Marxist-Leninist ideology which influenced the more egregious human rights abuses, and even genocide, that they would commit. Some academics posit racial thinking and xenophobia as the root of their evil, while others make the case that what, on the face of it, look like targeted racial genocides were still motivated more by a commitment to a thorough and pure Marxist-Leninist revolution. I'll try and give space for both sides of that debate as we move through the series, but I think, and this is somewhat influenced by my own writing about the subject, however minor that may be, that there is always a space that can take both of these sides into account. And I think the young Salot Tsar is already showing us some of that, clearly showing the growing influence of communist thinking on the students in Paris, but also the kinds of what I guess we could term Cambodian frames of thought that will also characterize the revolution he will eventually lead, and the ways that Cambodian society was almost uniquely unsuited to an orthodox Marxist-Leninist revolution. And it's that dynamic between those two forces there that is going to be extremely interesting, but also is going to tell us a lot about what happened in Pol Pot's Cambodia. But as I said, perhaps we are getting a little bit too far ahead of ourselves again. But I want to spend the rest of this episode looking at the continuing development of this student group in Paris, now committing itself to a certain vision of Cambodia's future, in the wake of Sihanouk's own moves to solidify his version of Cambodia's future under his reign. So at this point, getting toward sort of the second half of 1952, the so-called Cercle Marxiste, and that's Marxist Circle for anyone who is having trouble with my butchered French, they were influencing many of the Cambodian students in Paris. They were more or less led by Yangtze, and Salot Sar had joined one of its cells, giving him and many others a real purpose. In the words of Philip Short, a sense of belonging and a goal. Suddenly, they were part of a worldwide movement, endowed with a transcendent mission. As the incarnation of good that would triumph over evil. End quote. It is during this time that many members of the Cercle Marxiste, including Salot Sar and Yangtze, they also join the French Communist Party, or PCF, Paris Communiste Français. Again, sorry for anyone that can actually speak French. This was at a time, and we've mentioned it a fair bit, that communism really seemed like a noble cause that was sweeping parts of the globe. And in France at this time, the Communist Party was getting like 25% of the electorate. Being a communist was a badge of honour. And it's against that backdrop that we should remember the students are trying to make sense of the world. With that being said, it might be hard for some of us to imagine some of the influences that they are getting into. You know, like Stalin, for one. We don't really find that as a normal, okay thing for people to be doing in this day and age, do we? Yangtze had a poster of Stalin on his wall, and it is that influence that I want to kind of sit on for a while. The French Communist Party was very keen on Stalin, and in this, the year before his death, the cult of personality around him was at its height. We've touched on how these Cambodian communist students were meeting up in the, you know, divided cells and reading certain communist texts in their study sessions and self-criticism sessions. But Philip Short notes how very few of these students in the Cercle, or those who would go on to be revolutionaries, they weren't very familiarized with the weighty and wordy tomes of Marx and Lenin. Some did, sure, as we've said, there were some genuine intellectuals among their ranks, like Yangtze or Tian Mun, and later Kyo Sampan. But for someone like Salot Sar, who wasn't really quite at that level. He himself confessed later that the big, thick works of Marx, I didn't really understand them at all. Another contemporary of these students, Ping Se, said that simply, Marx was too deep for us. That isn't to say that they were not engaging with the ideas in a general sense, but I think many of us would be able to share this inability to sit down with any extremely rigorous or deep academic work that we weren't familiar with and, you know, really try and get your head around it. Most of us aren't going to read a PhD student's thesis about some deep aspect of, I don't know, economics. But if we wanted to learn about money, we might pick up some, you know, basic book on investment designed for a general audience. But for some of the Cambodian students looking to immerse themselves in this way of thinking, and for Sar in particular, there were a couple of essays written by Stalin that he found to be far more accessible, titled Marxism and the National Question, and the other was The History of the Communist Bolshevik Party of the USSR. Philip Short points out some of the lessons that these texts hammered home. And I know I'm quoting him a lot, but I really do think this section of his book is quite brilliant. Quote, Stalin's precepts marked indelibly the thinking of the future Cambodian revolutionaries. He stressed the importance of correct leadership, without which the cause of the proletarian revolution will be ruined, and of criticism and self-criticism. He taught that Marxism-Leninism was not a dogma, but a guide to action, constantly enriched by new revolutionary experience. And above all, he urged eternal vigilance. And here he quotes Stalin's essay. One of the watchwords of the Bolshevik Party is that the party grows ever stronger by cleansing itself of opportunist elements. End quote. And what this is drumming into these Cambodian would-be revolutionaries is that the revolutionary vanguard party would always need to be watching its back, being wary of infiltration by enemy agents, foreign organizations, and that the way to correct these elements, which he likens to ulcers in a healthy body, these, I'm going to quote him, dregs of the human species, was with pitiless repression. And these are the kind of sentiments that we would probably expect from a leader who condemned hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of his own people to the gulag or the firing squad, doesn't it? One member of the Cercle Marxiste who was unconvinced by this kind of rhetoric was Ho Yuan, and he warned against confusing the elimination of the bourgeoisie as a class with the elimination of the bourgeois as individuals. Hu Yuan will be a leading member of the Khmer Rouge until he himself is killed by the Communist Party after speaking out against the evacuation of the cities in 1975. An example of the kind of pitiless repression that we will come to expect for those who go against the party center and who may have been influenced by Stalin. But again, we get ahead of ourselves. At this point in the story, in the early 1950s, we are really just trying to touch all the bases and just incorporate what kinds of influences these students at this point are looking at. And the Stalinist bent that many of them get on in this time, perhaps merely by dint of studying in Paris at a time when Stalinism itself was not a word that would instill fear and disgust, but rather admiration, well, that's something that needs to be pointed out. They are collecting all these experiences, and their worldview, like anyone's, is being impressed upon and transformed through their own circumstances. Mao was another big influence at this point, particularly his speech on New Democracy, which was originally given in 1940, and it kind of becomes a blueprint for revolution in a colonial or semi-colonial state. And it was very influential on Ho Chi Minh as well. It even led to the phrase New Democracies becoming communist jargon for countries transitioning toward socialist states. Perhaps even influential in setting up, you know, the word democracy as a synonym for socialism. You know, like the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Democratic Republic of Vietnam, or eventually, Democratic Kampuchea. The Chinese leader's speech is also really important for us, because it lays out a course for revolution that sidesteps the kinds of ideas that Marx thought were absolutely necessary for a socialist revolution, you know, based on the industrial class, or what might even be called a Western view of society and how revolution would naturally come about within them. Mao envisaged a two-step revolution in these other circumstances, where an allegiance of different classes, but based primarily on the peasantry, would be able to bring about a two-stage progression into socialism. I don't want to dwell too much on Mao and what we will end up calling Maoism for now, as we'll end up doing a bit of an in-depth thing on that in a later episode, but essentially this speech he gave and the subsequent, you know, publication of it, this On New Democracy, this gives the bright-eyed students who were looking to bring about a revolution this very exciting confidence. They don't have to wait for their society to transition into a capitalist, industrialized one, and wait for the proletariat to, you know, realize their position and start a revolution. This is kind of like how Lenin added this notion of a vanguard party that could lead a revolution. Well, Mao is also adding his gospel to the revolutionary socialist Bible. In this New Democracy publication as well, he also says that the universal truth of Marxism, quote, must be combined with specific national characteristics and acquire a definite national form if it is to be useful. And in no circumstances can it be applied subjectively as a mere formula. Marxists who make a fetish of formulas are simply playing the fool. End quote. So we're getting this evolution of Marxism into something less of a science and more into, I don't know, a vague set of principles where class-based struggle is still the key, but, you know, anyone can get in on this action. He's saying, look, anyone can embrace this. Make it your own. Add your own flavor. Make it work for you. Mao also said something that dovetailed quite nicely with the kinds of things these students might be taking away from the Book of Stalin as well, when he said, quote, either you cooperate with the Communist Party or you oppose it. The moment you oppose the Communist Party, you become a traitor. Whoever wants to oppose the Communist Party must be prepared to be ground into dust. If you are not keen on being ground into dust, then you had certainly better drop your opposition. End quote. We can see the beginnings of this development, can't we? On this idea of who is or who isn't an enemy. What a Communist Party needs to worry about. What you do with your enemies. As well as how to get it off the ground, how to make it work. And as Philip Short says, quote, with Stalin's grim prescriptions for maintaining purity in a revolutionary party, and Mao's guide to revolutionary practice, the young Khmer communists in the making seem to have most of what they needed. End quote. He also says that these students, even Yang Sari, who was probably the most familiar with Marxist theory, well, they really weren't bothering to get into the deeper aspects here. But they were still energized by this kind of ideology, the kind of worldview that so-called Marxists were espousing, energized by the confidence they were getting from looking at the world and the situation in Cambodia through this frame. If we put ourselves in the shoes of these young Cambodian students, feeling like an elite group already, and then you get them forming secretive cells and forming study sessions, hatching plans about changing the course of their country's history, it may not be surprising that they were drawn to what seem to us like fairly extreme positions. But to them, they thought that revolution was the most important thing that they could do. Keng Van Suk, the slightly eccentric genius who was remaining slightly more aloof from these more hardline communist positions, said at this point, before he went back to Cambodia, that Yang Sari and Salot Sar ate and slept revolution. Sari, being the leader at this time, probably would have been insufferable to be around. He had very excessive demands of the students who had joined his clique. At Tian Mum, the other elder of the Cambodian student group, and his French girlfriend, they had moved to a different hotel from Sari after he kept banging on their door at 6 in the morning and saying, there was political work to be done. Even telling some other members of the Cercle that they should stick to masturbating instead of wasting time with women. Presumably because there was political work to be done. Sari is going around and taking this all very seriously. He has this conversation with Van Suk at some point in 1952, and as it is recalled in Short's biography, he says that Sari said, I will direct the revolutionary organization. I will hold the dossiers. I will supervise the ministers. I will watch that they do not deviate from the line laid down by the Central Committee in the interests of the people. End quote. Like, he is confident. He is energized. He sees himself as Cambodia's future revolutionary leader. Because we are studying this moment in the story with the aim of, you know, looking at the influences that will become important to the future revolution, like if this was a recipe, we are still not quite cooking yet, and we're still listing the ingredients. If this was, say, a recipe for curry, and maybe I'm just a big fan of curry here, so this seems like the best example to me, but if you are looking at a curry, it's sitting there on some beautiful rice, but depending on where you are or what restaurant you're sitting in, you've got a huge difference in flavor country between like a gorgeous green Thai or like a lamb korma or a Penang or my favorite Cambodian curry, Amok. So if we talk about revolution in this sense, if we are talking about the end product, it really matters what ingredients you are putting in there, right? Like, the difference between a couple of curries is the spices you are using, yeah? It's still curry, but you can have massive distance in aroma, taste, heat, just tweaking the dials on those spices. I think any movement that is even self-proclaimed to be Marxist-Leninist in its aims is going to incorporate all of these little cultural nuances or interpret certain themes in certain ways. Or, as we've said, it could be influenced by the moment in history that they are operating within. That October Revolution in Russia in 1917 happened in a fairly unique moment in a world war that humans had never experienced. And Lenin and then Stalin, they had these particularities from Russian culture and the old Russian Empire. And the Cambodian students in Paris? Well, if we are deciding which spices and which ingredients are going to go into their revolutionary recipe, you know, before we actually get to the method part of the recipe, just lining up your measuring cups and teaspoons and tablespoons, we've covered a fair bit over the last few episodes. We've got half a cup of Marxist-Leninist ideology, we've got a quarter cup of Stalinism, a few tablespoons of Maoism, a few more of Cambodian cultural values and context, including Theravada Buddhism, which we will explore more in later episodes, but we will also need to include a large dollop of the French Revolution as well. Now, I'll point out here again, like I did earlier in the episode, different historians might give you different takes on this kind of thing. Like, they have a big spoonful of this curry once it's cooked and they say, whoa, 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 no, there is way more Maoism in this than what you think. Or they might say some other ingredient is missing altogether, or there isn't as much of this as this. Some might say, as we outlined before, that it wasn't communist at all. Others will say it was a thorough Marxist-Leninist revolution. I'm presenting what I think the ingredients are here, but I also just want to say that, like with all history, there are different interpretations as well. This is one. A fairly balanced one, if I don't say so myself, but, you know, an interpretation. With all of that being said, I hope I've made at least someone listening to this podcast want to have curry for their dinner tonight. But if we bring this back to the students in Paris, and what they are being influenced by, we've talked about these essays by Stalin, this speech by Mao. Most of them aren't reading the big, thick works of Marx, but they are at least considering the general framework of that worldview as a grounding for their own ideology. Now, the reason why the French Revolution is going to be an important influence and why we spent the better part of an older episode looking into it, is because its legacy for the Cambodian communists will be an example for them to use when they come up against the basic facts about the economic classes in their native country, and just how unsuitable it was to an orthodox Marxist revolution, or even the variances on that method that were developed by Lenin and Mao. Even Mao, ostensibly leading a peasant-based revolution, he will state that it cannot succeed without the modern industrial working class in some capacity. In Cambodia, there was nothing resembling an industrial working class, let alone a modern one. And once again, I will rely on Philip Short to eloquently describe the way that Salot Sar will find the missing piece of the puzzle here when he says, quote, "Even the Vietnamese, fired up by their missionary endeavor to create a Khmer revolutionary movement, were compelled to admit that conditions did not exist for a socialist revolution or even a new democratic revolution, but only for a revolution that is national in nature. For that, a different model was needed, which Saar discovered one weekend, browsing among the second-hand bookstalls that lined the banks of the Seine near the Pont Saint-Michel. 50 years later, it was the only book from his Paris days whose title he could remember. The Great French Revolution, by the Russian anarchist Prince Peter Kropotkin. It is a massive volume, running to 749 pages. And Saar admitted later that he did not understand all of it, but it held his interest long enough for him to persevere to the end. For the national revolution, which corresponded most closely to conditions in Cambodia, were not that of China or Russia, but the revolution of 1789, launched by an alliance of bourgeois intellectuals and peasants against the rule of Louis XVI. End quote. The French Revolution was, as you would expect, something that Saar and all Cambodian students who had attended primary school and onwards were familiar with. How a French king was overthrown, and a republic of liberty, fraternity, and equality declared. The subsequent period known as the Terror, explained as, you know, an exceptional measure in exceptional times, that, sure, killed many innocent people, but in the end, saved the French Republic. So if we add this familiarity with the legacy of the French Revolution, this example for revolution in what is essentially two feudal countries separated by 150 years or so, we have this basic familiarity with this violence and terror, and we add this to the kinds of modern ideologies coming out of the Soviet Union and Communist China, well, we are just about set with our list of ingredients that are going to go into this recipe. And soon, we will trace how the method in which it will be made will also create certain unique variances that will result in more human tragedy in the pursuit of what these groups confidently consider to be just and noble aims. By late 1952, many of the students that were engaged in this kind of politics in Paris were beginning to see their scholarships being cut off, particularly those who had openly criticized the king following his coup in June. Someone like Keng Vansat, who had wrote quite an essay in the Student Association newspaper about the actions of the king. Now, he was protected from any major reprisal because he was related to the Minister of Education back in Phnom Penh. However, he was ordered to return to Cambodia before he could finish his dissertation. Yang Sari's scholarship is severed, but he remains in Paris, getting on by his own means. Salot Sar's essay in the newspaper, Monarchy or Democracy, under his pseudonym, the original Khmer, this will not result in any political consequences to his scholarship. Why? Well, by the time he had written that essay, he had already neglected his studies at the radioelectricity school to the point where the authorities had already cancelled it. Saw had become a committed communist and revolutionary. His studies meant very little. In October of that year, following a rather lovely sounding holiday that many members of the Cercle Marxiste took on the beautiful west coast of France, with camping and swimming and hiking taking place amongst some discussions by the would-be revolutionaries about what they thought about the future of Cambodia. After this summer sojourn, we know that a meeting is convened by Yang Sari and Tion Mum in a farmhouse owned by a member of the French Communist Party, which was about an hour outside of Paris. Philip Short says there were three items on the agenda for the Cercle Marxiste. Number one, which rebel organization should they be supporting now that Sihanouk had seemingly gone against the political system and was in a kind of de facto alliance with the French? Number two, whether anything could be done to unite the different resistance groups together. Son Yoktan had failed to achieve the unity of the Issarak that some might have thought possible. And agenda item number three, whether the time had come for members of the Cercle to return to Cambodia and take part in the struggle themselves. What followed was a long conversation between the members that tried to take each position seriously. What about their former student friends like Hang Tuan Hak and Ia Sichao, who had joined up with Son Yoktan? They had a clear advantage as the most authentic nationalist group. Surely they would be the ones to throw support behind in order to wrestle power from the French in a national movement. But then other members of the group, like Yang Sari, they had come to the position that Son Yok Min's affiliation with the Viet Minh, the now Cambodian offshoot of the Indochinese Communist Party, the so-called Khmer Land. He argued that this was the most serious option to take, even though he and others were concerned about the close affiliation that movement had with the Vietnamese, whose motives, even at this early juncture, were not trusted by the Paris students. Now, if we were sat in this farmhouse in the French countryside, among this budding intellectual elite from Cambodia, we would notice, after a while, that each position raised in this plan for their country's future, well, it would get to a point where someone making a case for this way or that way would not really be able to support that argument with any real gumption. They didn't have the data, the real story. I mean, it was only like a year earlier that they even really found out that Son Yok Min was the leader of a Cambodian communist movement and, you know, got a picture of the guy. Likewise, any real news coming out of Cambodia about, you know, a traitor like Son Yok Tan, what he was doing out in the Marquise, well, this was unlikely to be reported on the equivalent of the nightly news, was it? The students from Cambodia, energized and confident as they were, didn't actually have much of a clue what was going on in Cambodia. How strong were Son Yok Tan's Khmer Serai? How much were the Vietnamese manipulating Son Yok Min? What was the position of the other Khmer Issarak, like Prince Chantarangzi? Just what the heck was going on down there? Well, perhaps as an indication of where these students see themselves, they decide, as Salot Sar later recalled, that someone should go back and carry out reconnaissance and make an assessment of the different resistance organizations. Then, we would take a decision over which movement we should support and which organization we should join. And the man who would become Pol Pot volunteered, declared that he was prepared to dedicate his life to the revolution. There was a secondary goal of this mission as well. The Cercle thought that there should also be an investigation to see what the prospects were for uniting the resistance movements. May Man, a member of the Cambodian Student Communists, and coincidentally one of the students who came with Tsar on that ship to France 3 years earlier, well, he remembered that Tsar had also made sense as the choice to go back because of the contacts he had. He had family at the Royal Palace, he had met Prince Chantarangzi as a child, he knew some of the guys that joined up with Son Yoktan, and he had also met the man he so idolized on a few occasions. It made perfect sense. Tsar, the unassuming, go-along kind of guy, hadn't made huge impressions during his time in Paris, hadn't been making waves in the cells of the Cercle Marxiste. But he had been on a journey since leaving Cambodia. He had seen a lot, met a lot of people, read a lot. He wasn't coming back with a degree, no, but he had come to a decision where that pursuit no longer held any interest. The confidence that the ideology he had come to accept gave him a mission in life. This was a big decision. He didn't have to do this. Plenty of other students had stayed on in Paris after flunking out of school. Or at his age, he could have gone home and had the experience and education to make a living doing something normal and certainly less risky. But this was a turning point. This wasn't just the tide carrying him along like it had throughout his childhood or teens, across Cambodia and now to Paris. He was making the choice, volunteering for something, declaring he was going to take the responsibility and prepare himself and his colleagues for the eventual seizure of power. Roughly 2 months later, on the 15th of December, 1952, Salot Tsar packed up his meager belongings. This was during the coldest part of winter in France, in his Spartan apartment on the corner of the Rue Letellier and Rue de Commerce, above the wine shop and cafe that he had been living in for 2 years, the room that was found for him by Keng Van Sack and via an association with Ieng Sary, who was now leading a Cambodian communist student group. Someone who had been just another of his acquaintances during their time in high school in Phnom Penh. Tsar had done a lot of reading in this room, forming ideas about his native country far from the rural village setting that he spent his childhood in Prexbau. Salot Tsar, wearing a winter coat that would not be getting much use back home, where it was about 40 degrees hotter than it was in Paris, I've left that in Fahrenheit for my American listeners. So he pops his coat on and he bids farewell to the student associates that he has become so close with over the last 3 years. Perhaps we would use the phrase comrade in a more appropriate way. And he hands the keys to his room over to a new tenant that he was able to organize to take his room. A young, bespectacled Cambodian who was studying political science, another recipient of a scholarship to study in Paris, and another member of the Cercle Marxiste, named Son Sen. Son Sen will, 25 years later, become a high-ranking member of the inner circle of the Communist Party of Kampuchea. In fact, overseeing the function of the apex of the country's security apparatus, S21. Salot Sar will head back to Cambodia on the very same ship that he rode in on, the SS Jamaica. From the cold winds of winter in Europe to the warm summer of Indochina. What better illustration or reference to this coming historical hurricane forming out of the weather systems of each part of the globe? And Salot Sar, in a way, is acting as the conduit between them. Philip Short points out that the ship itself was making one of its last journeys before being sold for scrap. And while Sar will again be bunking with soldiers making their way to fight in France's dirty war, the mood among them is now far less jovial. The war was not going well. Many of these conscripts will not return. Sar was returning to a Cambodia in turmoil as well. Sihanouk, who had made moves toward his control of the politics in Cambodia about 6 months earlier, was also facing a personal tragedy, one that Milton Osborne claims had a deep emotional effect on the king. His 4-year-old daughter, Kantar Bopa, had died of leukemia. Further to this, he was more and more convinced that the Democratic Party was in some way looking to abolish the monarchy or betray him in the same way that Sonyok Tan had. The National Assembly was abolished in a radio address. Sihanouk announced he would be ruling by decree, and he proclaimed martial law. He said that, quote, "From now on, any individual or any political party that opposes my policies will be declared a traitor to the nation and punished accordingly." This announcement came the very day that the SS Jamaica docked in Saigon. Sihanouk's moves to take care of his country had now produced an end of a political era. This was January 13th, 1953. And 6 months later, French military command would begin the process of choosing the region of Dien Bien Phu in the northwest of Vietnam as a potential area which might be turned into a fortified airbase capable of withstanding a siege from the Viet Minh. An interesting time for the young Pol Pot to join the Marquis. All of these developments will be the subject of the next episode of this series. And I want to thank you very much for listening to this one. Another long episode, a lot of names, a lot of different places. I really appreciate everyone listening to this show. If you are, you're a special person. Soon we will be discussing the end of the First Indochina War and the start of the road to revolution in Cambodia. So, until next time, again, this is Lachlan Peters. I want to thank again all the Patreon supporters of the show at this point and anyone who has made a donation by PayPal. It's very appreciated. So again, thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.